Hello, and welcome to Pod Emperor of Dune. I'm Elaine, a longtime sci-fi fantasy fan, reading Frank Herbert's classic science fiction Dune Saga for the very first time. I'm joined by my co-host Alex, who is tackling his first reread. Join our chapter-by-chapter deep dive into the series, as I make wildly incorrect predictions, Alex tries not to give anything away, and together, we learn to walk without rhythm.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Pod Emperor of Dune. I'm Alex here as Lies with Elaine.
Hey, guys.
Today, we're going to be continuing our journey through Children of Dune.
Yep. All right, so I'll get us started with the first epigraph for Chapter 4. This is from Dictionary Royal, 5th edition. So, as that implies, it is a definition.
Mm-hmm.
Melange. Melange, also melange. I don't know, it's like a pronunciation thing. N-S, origin uncertain, thought to derive from ancient Terran Franz. I'm assuming that is a weird future way of saying Earth French. A, mixture of spices. B, spice of Arrakis, parentheses dune, with geriatric properties, first noted by Yanshuf Ashkoko, royal chemist in reign of Shakad the Wise, Araki Melange, found only in deepest desert sands of Arrakis, linked to prophetic visions of Paul Muad'Dib Atreides, first Fremen Mahdi, also employed by Spacing Guild Navigators and the Bene Gesserit. So, I mean, this doesn't tell us a ton that we don't already know. It's kind of just, what is spice?
Mm-hmm.
Which we basically know already, but I think the key interesting bit of information is that it refers to Paul as the first Fremen Mahdi.
Mm-hmm.
So potentially implying that there are others in the future at whatever point this was written.
Yep.
I mean, why would you say first if there weren't others, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the chapter, of course, which we'll get into, has these cats going after these kids, which resemble the Atreides twins. So that could allude to something about the children.
Oh, it's like maybe one of them will become the next Mahdi.
Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, I can't really think of something else that links this epigraph to this chapter, because it has nothing to do with spice.
Yeah, although, as we've noted in the past, it's sometimes been difficult to find links between the chapters and their epigraphs, so might not be one.
I'm trying here.
Mm-hmm. All right, makes sense. Well, with that, let's get into this chapter and its cats.
Mm-hmm. This very short chapter and its cats.
Very, very short chapter. All right, so we begin by being introduced to two Laza tigers, apparently a breed of big cats bred through artificial selection of ancient Earth or Terran tigers. This is pretty common in sci-fi to refer to Earth as, like, Terra, and mm-hmm. Earth-related things as Terrans. Perhaps most famously, the Terran Empire in the Star Trek Mirror Universe.
Yep, that's certainly a good example.
Although clearly, Dune did it first. So the Laza tigers have big fangs, long and deadly sharp claws, big paws to allow them stability on uneven ground, coats that camouflage them against sand, and impressive intelligence. However, they've also been fitted with a sort of neural implant that makes them controllable by anyone who has the proper transmitter. Specifically, we meet two of these tigers who are standing on a ridge surveying their hunting grounds. Apparently, this is in an area of Seleucus Secundus, which has been left as a desert in an attempt to breed sandworms, which doesn't sound like it's been going very well from the brief mention we got in the chapter.
Right.
Suddenly, there is movement in the distance that makes the cat stand alert. Unfortunately, for anyone who has a heart, the movement is of two children, a boy and a girl of approximately 9 or 10 years old, both with red hair and dressed in Atreides-themed finery. The children are completely unaware of the danger, making no effort to keep their voices down or conceal themselves as they walk hand in hand. Which would be cute if it wasn't for what happened next.
Yeah, we kind of knew where this was going, though.
Yeah. Well, at first, I thought it was going to be, like, a test of control, like, whether they could stop the cats from attacking the children, but in fact, that's the opposite of what happens.
Yeah.
So, the tigers know what to expect, having played this game before, as is ominously stated in the chapter, and they wait for the proper signal from their neural implants to begin the chase, which they know is coming. So, it seems that these are not the first children to be sacrificed to these particular Laza tigers. A man approaches from behind the tigers and checks out the scene. He carries the transmitter strapped to his chest, and he is familiar enough to the tigers that they don't even turn to look at him. Clearly, he's their handler. He is apparently a Levenbrek, a rank of Sardaukar that is an aide to a Bashar. He speaks into a microphone to relay that the cats have seen the children. Apparently this is a test. They want to see if the tigers will chase down the children without being given a specific chase command, as they have been previously. So the Levenbrek presses a button that seems to release the cats from the command not to attack, keeping his hand over a different button to stop the tigers if they decide to attack him once he's released them from the first command.
Probably a good precaution.
Yes. But he does not give them a specific chase command, and as he had hoped, the cats ignore him and instead begin to stalk the children. So it seems like there's a two-step process where usually he would release them from the do-nothing command and then have a specific, okay, go chase command.
Mm-hmm.
But they want the cats trained to not need that second command and to just kind of chase when they see kids who look like this.
Right. Make them a little bit more autonomous.
Yeah. So presumably they will somehow get these cats to somewhere where the Atreides twins are. And they won't need men on the ground to, like, command the cats to do anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they can basically just release the cats and then wait.
Yeah. These particular children don't stand a chance, and in fact don't even seem to be aware that they are in danger even once they see the cats, appearing to view them as primarily an unusual curiosity right up until the moment the cats break their necks and begin to feed.
Lovely.
Yeah, I mean, I guess at least it was over quickly. The Levenbrek asks whether he should stop the tigers from doing this, but his superior tells him to let the tigers feed as they've done well. So, a reward for good behavior, the corpses of 9-year-old children. Apparently, this is a particularly superb set of tigers, and everyone is very impressed with this outcome. A transport is being set to retrieve the Levenbrek, who dreams of the promotions he will get due to his performance this day. Importantly, we learn that he serves in the corps of Faridin, the grandson of the late Emperor Shaddam. So I guess one of Irulan's siblings must have had kids, because obviously she didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And there is apparently a plan to get Faridin restored to his, quote, rightful, unquote, throne, which of course requires eliminating the Atreides twins, obviously the point of today's exercise.
Yep.
And that is the end of our very short chapter.
So, the Carino's back in the mix?
Yeah, that was kind of surprising. I kind of assumed the Emperor would just kind of die on Seleucus Secundus. I didn't really think about the fact that Irulan's sisters could have kids. I'm actually kind of surprised that Paul didn't, like, lock them up for the sake of preventing them from having potential legitimate heirs.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I didn't really think about it, because she has at least... I feel like she's referred to sisters in the plural, so she has at least two.
Maybe he just didn't see them as a threat.
Well, maybe they're not a threat, but their kids are. And they're all Bene Gesserit, right? Or trained as Bene Gesserit?
Yeah, they are all Bene Gesserit trained. But, I mean, his prescience wasn't great in the last book. And he wasn't focusing that far ahead. So, probably a fair chance that this wouldn't have really come into his visions.
Yeah, I don't know. Just seems like a potentially obvious problem. That if you don't cut off the bloodline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but interesting to bring them back, and they do seem quite brutal, obviously killing some children right here, which seems to be a turn back to what we had in the first book, where we had the Harkonnens, who were villains, who were pretty vicious, and then the middle book didn't really have that, you know? You had, like, a conspiracy, and obviously Paul was, like, an asshole, and there was a lot of shitty stuff going on in the Empire, but you didn't
have
these,
like... Well, yeah, so you didn't have, like, this clear, like, morally good or bad...
You didn't have, like, these chaotic, maniacal enemies that were in here who are just being evil for the sake of being evil.
Yeah, like, in the first Dune, towards the end, you get a little question-y about whether Paul is, like, a really good character, per se. But you never have a question that the Harkonnens are just straight-up evil.
Yeah, and you know that Paul isn't, like, a crazy sadist who's, like, going around murdering people just for the joy of it.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, these people aren't doing it for the joy of it. They have a purpose. But still, I mean...
Sacrificing innocent, like, 9-year-old kids is pretty horrific.
Yeah.
Like, that's terrible. I do wonder how old this kid is, this Faridin, like, because, I mean, realistically, he could be anywhere from younger than the twins up to 20.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, he obviously didn't exist before. I think we would have heard if there was a potential Carino heir earlier. So, like, in Dune, actually, we probably would have known about that in Dune Messiah, but, like, in theory, it could have been any time after the exile to Seleucus Secundus until recently. Mm-hmm. So it makes you wonder if it's this Faradin, or did you say it was Faradin?
I think it's Faradin.
Okay. It's got like an apostrophe in the middle of it. Never sure how to accent or stress these things.
Yeah, I think that was one of the ones that Frank pronounced.
Okay. I'll have to try to stick to that. My mind wants to say it the other way. But so it makes you wonder if he himself is directing this, or if it's kind of like a regent situation like it is with Aaliyah and the twins. Mm-hmm. Although even more of a real regency, because presumably this kid is not preborn.
True.
Yeah, interested to actually meet this character, which we won't, at least in this episode. Mm-hmm. But I do hope we kind of, you know, in Dune you cut back to the Baron and the Harkonnens periodically. In Messiah you cut back to the conspirators, so I hope we get to cut back to what's happening on Seleucus Secundus from time to time.
Yeah, there's no reason that that trend wouldn't continue.
All right, shall we move on to the next chapter?
Just one correction on the epigraph. We were actually wrong. Star Trek would have actually been first with the use of Terran, because the original series is in the late 60s and this was 76.
The first book, yeah, that's a good point. Mm-hmm. I don't remember if it was used in the first book, but I don't remember that it was.
No, I don't remember seeing it until now, honestly.
Interesting. Well, whoever was first. It's pretty common sci-fi trope that I've seen mm-hmm. in multiple places by this point.
Yep, and Dune was 64, so pretty close.
Mm-hmm. All right, so on to chapter 5. So this is from The Preacher at Arrakeen. And of course, this is capitalized, so this is the preacher that
the preacher.
We keep hearing so much about, who may in fact be, and I would guess probably is, Paul. I mean, it's possible that it's not, but it would seem like such a lead-up for it not to be. Mm-hmm. But, you know, everyone's speculating that it is. Although, hey, maybe Frank will surprise us. All right, so the epigraph goes, "The Fremen must return to his original faith, to his genius in forming human communities. He must return to the past, where that lesson of survival was learned in the struggle with Arrakis. The only business of the Fremen should be that of opening his soul to the inner teachings. The worlds of the Imperium, the Landsraad, and the Chome Confederacy have no message to give him. They will only rob him of his soul." So, it seems like Paul is trying to convince the Fremen to pretend his whole Empire reign thing never happened. And just be like, hey, let's rewind all that. Ignore all that Muad'Dib stuff. He fucked up. Go back to your old ways. Reject the Imperium. Do your own thing again. Basically, go back to what Stilgar was reminiscing nostalgically about in the first chapter. Mm-hmm. Which, like, I get, because Paul is very regretful, but at the same time, it's so deeply frustrating to be like, you are responsible for them being different now. You did this. And now you're like, oh yeah, my bad. Ignore that. Undo everything that I did to you.
Yeah, I don't know if I have the same feelings about it, though, because I sort of see it as, like, he understands where things went wrong and he's trying to correct what happened, right? It's not really, I don't really feel any malice towards Paul for trying this redemption now, right?
No, I'm not saying that he shouldn't be doing it. I'm just saying it's like,
assuming this is Paul.
Yes, assuming this is, in fact, Paul. I'm trying to think of an analogy, but it's like someone saying, oh, go jump off this cliff. Let's go cliff diving. It'll be really great. And then, like, a bunch of people die. And then he's like, wait, we shouldn't do this anymore. This is a bad idea. And it's like, yes, you should course correct, but you were also responsible for it happening in the first place. It's just, like, frustrating because it's like, you did this.
Yeah.
You were the cause. And, like, I'm glad you've seen the light now, but this would have been helpful, like, before you caused all these problems.
Yeah, I know. I
he's
think
all
that,
like, this is bad for your soul. And I'm like, you did this.
Yeah, I guess. I think it goes without saying that that's the case. But regardless, I think it is an effective message because obviously Stilgar is feeling some, you know, yearning for the old ways at this point because of everything that's happened and, you know, him even thinking about killing the young Atreides children, right? I mean, it just goes to show that even someone that's, like, as strong-willed of a person as Stilgar is having significant second thoughts, that it's a message that must land really effectively with a lot of people.
At least some people. The thing is, so there were already people in the last book that we heard who were going, like, way back, hopefully Paul's not encouraging the virgin sacrifices and such.
He doesn't seem like a virgin sacrifice type guy.
No, I doubt it. I feel like he wants them to go back to pre-him, but not, like, the really old ways, maybe. So there was already a pre-existing, like, discontent with the way things were going, which, you know, was the reason that there was Fremen participation in the conspiracy to take down Paul at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's obviously continued. The one thing that I wonder about, though, is that the more time passes, the fewer people remember the way things were. We have mention of how the Fremen live without water discipline now, and there was someone in the previous book, like a young officer, who didn't even remember life in the sieges. Like, the farther you get away from the events, the harder it is to go back, and the fewer people who will remember, let alone remember fondly, the old ways.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, like, a time limit on how long you have to do this.
Right.
And for this message to really be effective.
Yeah, because at some point, they're just going to die out.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting that if this is, in fact, Paul, and I am laboring under that assumption, it could be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But if it is, that he was so frustrated with his role and the mantle that he took up, but then he turns around and is like, well, I guess I'm going to be a religious figurehead again. This worked out really well last time. Manipulating the religious tendencies of this people did such wonders for my agenda last time. Let's run this again and hope it works out better. So we'll see what we learn about the preacher as we go forward. But certainly we've had a lot of allusions to and mentions of him so far.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel comfortable at this point making a prediction of whether the preacher is Paul or not?
No.
Okay. We'll come back with that.
I lean strongly towards it, just because at least Leto seems pretty sure that it is. Ganim is maybe a little bit more hesitant to commit, but they both seem to think it's a strong possibility. And since, you know, they can actually be Paul, I guess I trust their judgment on that matter, mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
But we'll see.
Yeah. Could always throw a monkey wrench into the mix.
Yeah, that'd be a real red herring. The preacher just turned out to be some rando, like, Fremen homeless guy in the desert. The end is near. All right, so let's dive into the chapter itself, which has nothing to do with the preacher.
Mm-hmm.
It instead has to do with the arrival of Lady Jessica, who lands in Arakeen, greeted by an immense crowd of 500,000 people who have all come to witness the return of the mother of Muad'Dib. Jessica is not feeling her best after the long journey and the memories that it has provoked, but she wears the garb of a Fremen Reverend Mother and is determined to play the part expected of her. She uses her Bene Gesserit observation skills to check out the crowd, seeing the city folk, the desert Fremen, the pilgrims, and a new faction called the Society of the Faithful, who dress in green, and we will shortly learn were created by Leia. She reflects on the 20 years that have passed since she arrived on this planet with her beloved late Duke Leto as her landing party waits for Aaliyah's group to join them, and she notes the differences in the landscape from the last time she was here. In particular, the gigantic structure of the keep which Paul had built as his fortress, but which is now home to Aaliyah's faction of fanatics, described as the most powerful governing force in the galaxy. So it seems that they are perhaps successors to the Kizarat.
Mm-hmm.
Which maybe Aaliyah has kind of created to replace that group after it was kind of maybe discredited by Korba's betrayal in the last book. We don't really know.
Yeah, they could also just be kind of like brand new loyalists that came out of the woodwork. I don't know if there'd necessarily be a tie to the old Kizarat, because as you said, they were heavily discredited, so I don't know if she would have trusted anyone who was part of the organization.
Well, that's why I'm saying they were like successors too, like they replaced the Kizarat. Yeah.
In like a sense of how they function in society.
Yeah, I mean, if they are the most powerful governing force in the galaxy, that seems like they took the place of the Kizarat,
mm-hmm.
which was basically the network of theocratic bureaucracy running before.
Yeah, it seems like, and we don't really get a lot of government workings in this chapter, but it at least seems from the information that we have now that it's even more despotic than it was under Paul, right? Because Paul sort of had like a small checks and balances system because he had the Kizarat that he was kind of going back and forth between, and he was kind of like pinned on some things because they were kind of like the religious power, right? But it seems like Aaliyah has sort of like removed that from the equation at this point. She has like her order here that's like the all-powerful group, and there isn't really a contender against that.
Yeah, we don't really learn a lot, but at least based on the kind of glimpses we get, it does kind of seem like they are first and foremost loyal to her. Although I do wonder if she struggled with any of the same things that Paul did, in which she ultimately couldn't control some of the things that they did.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we'll learn more.
Yeah, but it's also an example of, like, where you had Paul before, right, who was, I mean, obviously he was a dictator, but some might say that he was a benevolent dictator, maybe. I mean,
I wouldn't.
You wouldn't, but maybe more so than somebody who could follow him and be even more sadistic, right? Having someone in a position of power like that who you elevate, and he was elevated by the Fremen into this position where he was ruling, can open up some doors there down the line for potential successors who may be a bit more sadistic or evil or ill-intentioned.
Well, I mean, that's the whole problem with, like, an inheritance-based monarchy, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're, like, a great king, your kid might be an asshole and that they're the heir.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, Aaliyah is the regent to the heirs.
Or even not necessarily a monarchy or a hereditary-based system, but a system of government where one person or entity has significant power that can't be challenged.
I mean, yeah, you could have a, you know, technical democracy. Like, there are some today where people vote, but somehow it always goes to the same mm-hmm. the same person who's in power for, like, 40 years.
Right.
Maybe trades places with their prime minister to get around some term limits and then goes back. I'm certainly not thinking of any nations in particular. Anyway, we do get an interesting note here when Jessica is looking at the fortress that it must be torn down, but then there's no elaboration in her thoughts about why that would be.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe she just thinks it's really ugly.
I don't know. It could also just be an indication of her dislike for what's happened after everything that went down in the first book.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of like the fallout of that just being a mess.
Yeah, or she just sees it as a monument to what ultimately led to the downfall of her son, or mm-hmm. something like that. I don't know. All right, so the greeting party approaches, and Jessica observes them. Stilgar is among them, as is Irulan, whom Jessica seems to harbor an oddly personal dislike for. And she seems personally annoyed that Irulan is still as beautiful as she was before and doesn't seem to have aged 20 years. So that was just kind of odd. I don't know. Jessica doesn't really seem the type to be flustered by insecurity or anything, but she seems, like, personally affronted at the idea that Irulan's still pretty.
Well, Irulan was related to the Emperor that helped orchestrate the downfall of House Atreides.
Irulan didn't do it.
No, I'm not saying that she did it, but she was related to the person who did it, so it could be.
So we should hold all people responsible for the sins of their relatives?
I'm not saying that we should, but Jessica might have feelings about this.
I don't know. I think it's ridiculous. I mean, I would think that she would be potentially upset with Irulan for participating, even poorly, in the conspiracy to kill Paul.
Also a possibility.
But I don't think she would harbor specific anger towards her about being a Carino. But at any rate, I just thought it was, like, an oddly petty thing for Jessica to think. She then turns to Aaliyah, who is leading the group, and no sooner does she look upon her daughter than she can see confirmation of what she had feared. Aaliyah is an abomination. So that didn't take long. I feel like we got some thoughts from Aaliyah in the last chapter of, like, oh, well, like, maybe I'll distract her from the twins and she won't notice, like, what's going on with me. And she's like, nope. Your mother saw you for, like, half a second and knew what was up. Jessica's fear is that something similar might have happened to the twins.
Mm-hmm.
Aaliyah's group waits at the bottom of the exit ramp from the landing pad, and Jessica begins to go down to meet them, but not without executing a plan that she and Gurney had devised to root out those who might wish her harm. She steps out into the sunlight at the top of the ramp alone and raises her arms before the crowd, who kneel before her. Although there are some groups who do so more slowly than others in the crowd. This seems like fairly thin evidence to me, but Gurney and her other security forces, with the aid of some of Stilgar's men, rush into the crowd and start arresting people who knelt down too slowly. Some of these people, likely the ones who are the most likely to actually be guilty of something, see the danger coming and try to flee, but they're quickly killed. By, like, throwing knives through this crowd of kneeling people, which seems safe.
They got good aim.
I hope so. You got that one guy who's a little off his aim and is just like, oh, sorry, man. Sorry about that knife through your wife's forehead, but I was aiming for this fleeing bad guy. You know how it is. At any rate, the ones who aren't killed are quickly hustled away for questioning. Like, for... I was reading this and I'm just like, okay, I know the Fremen are, like, generally a pretty ableist society and things like that, but I'm sure at least a few of the people in the crowd have bad knees and just, like, took a minute longer to kneel down because they're not super fit.
Yeah, there
this
wasn't...
is just such, like, a, like, broad strokes thing of just, like, oh, those people were a little slow on the kneel.
Yeah, it also, like, it's not only that it just seems like a weird plan because, and later we learn that Gurney and Stilgar were kind of working together on this, so maybe Stilgar, like, knew who the people were and kind of, like, called them out, so they were able to eliminate them or something. But even that's kind of a stretch. And secondly, it's just kind of a weird read, because Frank doesn't really telegraph what's going on. He's just like, oh, and Gurney and some men jump out and, like, throw knives at people, like, randomly. And it's
there's
like,
also,
what's going on?
We just got mentioned that there are 500,000 people. There are 500,000 people.
Yeah.
How many men are going out? How did you even, like, see that clearly? Who in this massive crowd? Like, what is your gauge for kneeling too slowly? Like, I have so many questions about this.
And how does this not turn into absolute calamity? When,
like chaos.
Yeah,
I know
a
most
bunch
people
of dudes
are kneeling, but, like, I'd panic if, like, there are knives being thrown and people running through the crowds arresting people. Like, this should have turned into, like, a riot.
Yeah. I mean, maybe the people just know better than to riot because it's probably, you know, they'd all just get executed or something,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that is true. But, like, the other thing, and Jessica does make this point to her credit in her own thoughts, but, like, anyone who's actually a halfway competent conspirator would be a better actor and would just kneel on command because they're supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is, like, only gonna filter out people who are, like, dumb enough that they can't conceal their feelings in a crowd of other people who are all doing the same thing. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know. This whole thing I thought was so silly.
Yeah, it was ridiculous.
Like, it could not possibly be that effective.
I try to cut Frank Herbert slack in a lot of areas, but this is just stupid.
Like, I could see the stuff in the last book where, you know, Paul is using his abilities to, like, question the room full of Fremen naives and, like, is able to use his observation and, like, gauge who among them are, like, guilty and not. But that was, like, a room full of people, and it was, like, more about reading body language. This was not a crowd of, like, 500,000 people.
Yeah.
Where you're trying to gauge how quickly they knelt down before Jessica. Anyway, very silly. So the rest of the crowd seems to have no misgivings at all about these events, apparently. Instead, interpreting events exactly as Jessica had planned for by planting rumors here ahead of her arrival somehow. The mother of Muad'Dib had returned to weed out the insufficiently faithful. So, I mean, I guess that's why the crowd is cooperating. They maybe didn't expect this exact event, but once they saw it, it kind of just fit into their expectations that she had somehow planted.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe through similar propaganda networks that, like, her husband used to use. But
yeah, maybe.
Still feels thin to me, but at any rate.
A little bit of hand-waving going on here.
A lot of hand-waving. Jessica remains standing with her arms upraised throughout this whole process, with the people remaining prostrate before her. When it is done, she lowers her arms and the crowd surges to their feet cheering. Jessica then finally walks down the ramp to meet the greeting party. However, she ignores Aaliyah for the moment to greet Stilgar first, so a bit of a snub. She notes the gray in his beard that has no bearing on the continued intensity of his personality. He welcomes her with a compliment regarding the operation that was just carried out, and reveals that he helped Gurney to plan it and that some of his men had helped out. They have an interesting exchange where she reflects that he used to observe her pretty closely back in the day, and he replies that studying and learning from survivors is important. Aaliyah then steps forward, and Jessica knows that it is pointless to try to hide what she has seen from her daughter. Just as Aaliyah could not conceal her secret from Jessica, Aaliyah will be able to read Jessica and know that she has learned the secret.
Mm-hmm.
Jessica reflects that they are now worse than mortal enemies. So, that's quite a transition. Maybe you shouldn't have abandoned your daughter here, Jessica. Maybe you should have parented her, and this might not have happened. Leah starts off their conversation on a great foot, raging at Jessica's audacity at springing this operation on her without asking consent, which, to be fair, is kind of a fair point, considering that Aaliyah is in charge here. The fact that she ran this, like, unsanctioned crowd sting without giving a heads up to the actual regent of the planet slash city slash empire slash whatever, not in greatest taste.
Yeah, I mean, for all she knows, they could have been under attack. I mean, probably not from her mother, but still.
When Jessica protests that it was planned with Stilgar, Aaliyah turns her anger on him, demanding to know whom he is loyal to. He smartly replies that he is loyal to Muad'Dib's children, and that the operation was intended to help remove threats to them. And Jessica manages to get in a barb by asking why such an outcome does not please Aaliyah. Aaliyah collects herself and smiles at Jessica, telling her that she is pleased, and Aaliyah is in fact surprised to know that she does feel some happiness in the moment. Having been stressing about Jessica finding out what's been going on with her, she's basically relieved that it's out in the open now, and that she still maintains power here, at least so far. Aaliyah tells Jessica that they will discuss the matter more later, and Jessica turns to Irulan. The two look at each other for a moment, the two Bene Gesserit who had broken their vows for love. Or at least that's what we're told, but I still think the Irulan was secretly in love with Paul the whole time and only realized it when he was dead thing is both ridiculous and a pretty weak character development. Especially since she is now described as living only for the children that this man had with another woman. But that is unfortunately what we are told, and as a result, she broke with the Order. To be fair, I think she had more than enough fodder to break with the Order without some ridiculous unrequited love BS, such as, oh, I don't know, being ordered to probably sacrifice her life in an attempt to murder a pregnant lady, but hey, what do I know? Better go with the secretly in love the whole time thing instead. I still think a much better plot point would have been if she just decided to betray the conspiracy in the last book, like you had suggested.
Yeah.
I think that would have just been a much stronger, like, character development.
Mm-hmm.
It would have made her a lot more interesting of a character than, like, I really loved him the whole time, and I was just sad because he wouldn't bone me.
Yeah, I feel like every author has strengths and weaknesses, right? I feel like Frank Herbert's really good at world building. There's always, like, really interesting things get thrown in there. Like, the last book had, like, the Tlalaxu that were thrown in there. They were fascinating. The Fremen have always been an interesting culture. Like, there's tons of that all over the place. But with character development, he tends to focus on some characters and not other characters. Like, Paul got tons of character development. I know he was the main character, but he definitely did. Jessica did in the first book, right?
Mm-hmm.
Second book, perfect example of Irulan getting, like, you know,
just, like, abandoned halfway through the book and then getting, like, a bizarre off-screen plot development mm-hmm. that really didn't make any sense with her previous characterization.
Yeah, and some weakness for Chaney, too, where she got fleshed out pretty well in the first book. Then in the second book, it was, like, a lot worse.
Yeah, right? And then she died.
And then she died, yeah.
Yeah, I would kind of agree that there are definitely some weaknesses of characterization. So I am glad to have Jessica back in the picture as, I think, one of the stronger characters.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, I think the twins are being developed well enough. But then again, we've only had, like, two chapters each with them by the end of this, so.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's true.
Anyway, moving on from Irulan's weird plotline. Jessica asks Irulan where her grandchildren are, and Irulan tells her that they are still at Siege Tabor, which Jessica approves of because of the potential dangers of bringing them here to Arakeen. Irulan nods, suspicious of Jessica. As a Bene Gesserit, she had seen the weirdness between Jessica and Aaliyah, but she doesn't know the true cause, at least in part because Aaliyah has basically primed her to believe that there's going to be conflict, because Jessica has her own plans for the twins, and presumably this plays on Irulan's protective instincts towards them. However, in Irulan's defense, she isn't a reverend mother like Jessica or Aaliyah, so I'm not sure that she would be able to recognize the signs of abomination.
Yeah, that was the indication I got as well. That Jessica probably has this experience from either her other memory or maybe just some sort of intel she has access to as a reverend mother.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, Irulan's definitely not. So she just, I think, maybe doesn't have the requisite background knowledge to, like she might theoretically know abomination is a thing, but she might not know enough to recognize it.
Right.
I'm not sure. Frank himself doesn't seem too forgiving of Irulan, describing her in what I think is meant as objective narration, as, like, not exactly stupid or anything, but too lazy to really apply herself. And I'm pretty sure that was just meant as, like, a statement and not one of Jessica's thoughts, at least the way I read it. So that seems like it's just, like, a statement about her character. So I think the implication is that she's siding with Aaliyah here, perhaps without appropriately considering that Jessica might, in fact, be on the right side.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, I think that's definitely true.
Right.
That she is just kind of, like, from the get-go, siding with Aaliyah and, I guess, believing Aaliyah's side of events. But then again, like, she knows Aaliyah, and as much as Aaliyah had seemed pretty despising of her at the end of the last book, it does seem like they've developed a working relationship. But Irulan doesn't really know Jessica. You know, they might probably met a couple times at the very beginning of the Empire, and then Jessica fucked off to Caladan and never came back, so.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I do wonder if Irulan will ultimately undergo an allegiance shift in the course of this book.
Mm-hmm. Shift back to the Carinos, maybe?
Oh, I was just going to say, maybe if she is wholly and truly concerned about the children's welfare, maybe she will see that Aaliyah is bad for them.
Oh, yes.
Like, maybe she will, like, switch to Jessica's side.
Mm-hmm.
Or, yeah, maybe, I didn't even consider maybe allying with the Carinos again, potentially. Although, I feel like if she is genuinely dedicated to the twins, she wouldn't do that.
Yeah, probably not, because they seem to have a very anti-twin
yeah.
thing going on.
Twin
right
murder.
Now.
No surprises, given what we've just learned about how Irulan is, at least currently, just kind of primed to be on Aaliyah's side. She takes Aaliyah's side here, chastising Jessica for not consulting the Royal Council about her little sting operation. But when Jessica asks whether Stilgar himself was not trusted enough to be the point of contact, Irulan wisely recognizes that there is no good answer and shuts up. She thinks that Jessica is just as haughty as she ever was, but considers the Bene Gesserit axiom that those who appear haughty are just building walls around their own fears and insecurities. But Irulan doesn't believe that this is true of Jessica, so the haughtiness must be a put-on, but why? And we're just left with that. Not really answered. But at least it indicates that Irulan is noticing and thinking about these things.
Mm-hmm.
Alright, so this tense conversation is derailed by the priestly portion of the delegation, who basically swarm Jessica, bowing and touching her arms, before the leaders speak with her. They are two men named Javid and Zabatalef, and they inform her that they will bring her to the keep for a lustration ceremony, whatever the hell that means. Jessica observes the two and finds that she likes neither of them. Zabatalef seems immediately annoying, constantly reminding her that he was the son of a naïb that Jessica knew from the old days, clearly someone who trades in social relationships with a ruthless nature under his jovial exterior. Javid, on the other hand, has a sort of repellent charisma and is clearly a man who keeps his thoughts to himself, and Jessica thinks that he's dangerous. He also has an unusual accent, like he comes from an isolationist group of Fremen whose speech had diverged from the main dialect, but when she asks where he is from, he evades the question. Like he just says something vague, like, from the desert. Javid tells her that the Society of the Faithful awaits her at the keep, and Jessica asks whether he is one of Aaliyah's appointees, which is confirmed. Javid seems annoyed, clearly knowing that this has marked him for further scrutiny by Jessica's entourage, particularly Gurney. Speaking of Gurney, he rolls up at this moment, signaling that the prisoners from the sting operation are under control and being interrogated. As usual, while Frank praises his fighting and espionage skills, he also makes sure to emphasize that Gurney is an ugly lump with a sinister scar.
No comment. Let's just move on.
He just is really in love with the phrase ugly lump.
Yeah.
He uses it every time Gurney is introduced, and it is just so unnecessary.
Like, where's the variety? Like, you can call him other things, too, I guess, right?
Anyway, despite his looks, Jessica, quote, loved him and prized him above all other living men, end quote, and he and Stilgar warmly greet each other. Javid again reminds Jessica about the lustration ceremony. She protests, using the voice to ask whether such priestly nonsense is truly necessary, as she wishes to see her grandchildren. So she puts on the annoyed grandma voice, I guess. Zabatalef is shocked at such words from his messiah's mother, but Javid seems unsurprised, allowing a smile to touch his face before quickly concealing it, obviously aware that Jessica would have noticed this and kind of annoyed about it. Basically, Jessica seems to infer from the smile that he was expecting such resistance from her, which could only mean that he is not merely a member of the society like Zabatalef seems to be, but in fact an agent of Aaliyah who was prepared for this encounter. Jessica considers having Gurney kill him, either literally right now or staged as an accident later, but decides against it, considering that he would be valuable if he could be turned into a double agent. Jessica tells the two men that she will attend the lustration if Javid insists, but they can only take one more person into their party, selecting Javid over Zabatalef. Javid looks around at the others and says that he apologizes for delaying her meeting with the twins, but matters of state require her presence. Jessica is secretly pleased that he is making her do this stupid ceremony, as the apparent victory will give him sway with his fellows, and might be considered a down payment on future services, if they do manage to convert him to their side. She is confident in her assessment that he can be bought once they figure out what, in fact, coin they will have to pay him with.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we don't get a ton about these two men. I assume Javid is going to be the more important one going forward. I feel like Zabatalev might only be here as like a contrast to Javid, but I guess we'll see if they both come back later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did find the reaction from Jessica to the priests, or rather, her reaction to their priestliness, I guess you could say, and then their subsequent reaction to her reaction, kind of funny.
Yeah.
That was a nice little piece to put in here.
I mean, aside from the whatever political machinations are going on here, if I had just gotten off a plane after a long-ass journey from who knows where, and I'm all excited to meet my grandchildren for potentially the first time in person, at least that's the implication that I've gotten, and some priest rolled up to me and were like, wait, you have to come do this religious ceremony first, I would be like, oh my god, fuck off.
Yeah, and I do think that in the second book, you're really missing a perspective like Jessica's, because she has, like, a generally morally sound perspective, but is also pretty relatable. So, you didn't really have that in the second book that much, right? Because you were mostly seeing things from Paul's perspective, with some cut-ins from conspirators, and then, you know,
Aaliyah sometimes. But Aaliyah, she's, like, sometimes part of his government and everything. Mm-hmm. You don't have an outside perspective from someone who, like, really disapproved of, but was not an enemy of. You know.
Yeah, and maybe Aaliyah was sort of a stand-in for that, but not really, because she didn't have, like, the experience of Jessica, so you couldn't really throw that in there. So it's nice to have a character back that sort of has that
experienced and mature perspective. Well, and, like, opposition to things was more about her personally not wanting to be involved, and her, like, regrets at having a normal life taken from her, and having to fulfill this role. Not really about the role itself, and, like, the dangers of the religion and everything. Whereas I think Jessica had that kind of outsider skeptical perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Even as she kind of helped bring everything into being.
Yeah, but now she's basically been removed at this point, for a whole book at least, mm-hmm. right?
I mean, openly being like, pilgrims cannot come to my planet, stop.
Yep.
She's like, I want no part of this, but here she is. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how she fits into this family and government and all that, given her, like, open disapproval for the way things have turned out.
Mm-hmm.
All right, do you want to move on to the final chapter for today?
Sure, let's do it.
All right, so the epigraph for this chapter is from Book of Diatribes from The Hate Chronicle. I give you the desert chameleon, whose ability to blend itself into the background tells you all you need to know about the roots of ecology and the foundations of a personal identity. I don't think that the knowledge of a chameleon tells you all you need to know about anything. But, okay, hate. I don't know, what do you make of this?
I don't fucking know.
I mean, it's a fun fact about the ecology of one particular desert creature, I guess. And I assume it's meant to be some kind of commentary on your identity forming to be similar to what you grow up around or are living around, but, like, I don't really know. More philosophical bullshit.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to find a way to tie it back to this chapter, because they do talk about the worms, right? That kind of comes up, like, the worms and the sand trout.
Yeah, there's definitely some discussions of, I guess, both ecology and identity. I just don't really see what this chameleon has to do with either of them.
Yeah, like, I'm already starting to feel a little bit guilty from saying that the epigraphs got better in this book, because This one straight up sucks, but yeah, I think they do get better at some point. This is just another, like, ponderous, I don't know if I'd even call it philosophical. Like, it just doesn't really fit.
Yeah, I don't know. It's the kind of thing where I read them, and if they're not immediately obvious, I kind of just move on because, like, we're doing this for fun, and I don't have time to, like, intensely ponder over, like, what do I think that he meant by, like, in Dune, they generally made sense of, like, revealing something about the world, and some of these have, like, the one in the last chapter was, like, revelatory about the views of the preacher in a way that we don't get directly from the chapters, but this one, I don't know.
I just feel like some of these, like, Frank Herbert feels like he's gonna get a, like, smoked a couple bowls, that's deep, man, reaction out of some of these, and that's just not the case, right? It's just, it's like a few layers below that's deep, man, you know?
Maybe if we had smoked a couple bowls, we'd think it was deep. It's
all about those chameleons, man.
Do our next podcast high. Anyway, let's move on to the chapter, which, disappointingly, has no chameleons.
Damn it. Well, you wouldn't see them if they were there.
Maybe there are chameleons everywhere and we just don't know.
Yep.
That's deep, man. Anyway. The twins are out in the desert as they wait for Jessica, who of course was delayed by the lustration ritual thing. Ganima didn't want to come out here in the open with night approaching, but Leto was feeling ill at ease and he wanted to. He's practicing the Balisette, a birthday gift from Gurney, at which he has some skill due to his ancestral memories, but still needs practice because he lacks the muscle memory. So even if they didn't visit, at least they sent birthday presents.
Oh, how nice.
Ganima knows that Leto plays the Balisette to soothe himself from particularly troubling thoughts, so it's an indication that Leto is unsettled about something. As he plays, he can feel the memories of his father and presumably grandfather of Gurney playing the instrument back in Caladan, and he's overcome with nostalgia for a place he's never actually known. Amusingly, as he plays, Ganima taps her foot impatiently because she doesn't want to be here, but she's so in sync with her twin that she ends up tapping her foot to the tune that he's playing. So I thought it was kind of cute. Leto tries to play an ancient song, far older than anything that Gurney would have played. It's a bit maudlin, and Ganima questions his choice, pointing out that Gurney would think it was sentimental nonsense. Obviously, because she shares the same set of memories, she knows the song too, but Leto is still overcome by how connected the two of them are. However, he also knows that despite the many things they share, they are different people, and he fears the divergence that he feels beginning between them. Specifically, something, not revealed until later in the chapter, has begun to happen to him that has not happened to her, and he can't bring himself to tell her about it just yet. So he's kind of overcome with this idea of my sister and I are basically the same person at this point in our lives. And they even make a comment in, I think, Leto's thoughts that if one of them died, they would still kind of almost live on through the other, even though they don't share each other's memories, but they share so many ancestral memories and have lived their lives together so closely that they would basically kind of live on in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But he's a bit afraid of the fact that he knows their lives are going to start taking different courses.
Right.
Although I'm sure they'll always be, like, very close.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to have, like, a deeper-than-standard twin connection. Leto stares out into the desert, which no longer shows the tracks of migrating sandworms as it often used to, and it is bordered by water and plant life, symbols of the Atreides' reign. There are even forests beginning to grow in some parts of Arrakis, and some of the younger inhabitants of the planet aren't even surprised by this, kind of as we alluded to, that as time goes on, the people who remember the way things used to be are just going to die out, and you're going to have all people who are just used to the current status quo.
Yep, you're going to have these young people who are listening to all these old people talking about the good old days.
And they're going to be like, good old days? We have water now, Grandpa. And I don't run the risk of being eaten by a giant worm.
Back in my day.
You kids have it too easy with all this grass and trees and water. Back when I was a kid, I had to drink my own piss filtered through my snowsuit. Yeah, I really feel like that's not convincing to the kids of today. Anyway. However, while Leto may be physically one of those young people, he has ancestral memories, and he's somewhat fearful of the degree of change occurring here, and we'll get into why shortly. He comments that the Fremen children rarely find sand trout near the desert surface anymore, although Ganima is already annoyed by being here and doesn't see why this particular factoid is relevant. Leto says that it's just an indication of how much things are changing. Night is beginning to fall, and apparently this is a time when Leto tends to struggle with his ancestral memories, which appear to clamor for space in his head. Ganima doesn't struggle with it the way that he does, but she knows of his struggles, laying a hand on his shoulder in comfort and asking whether they should go back inside now. Apparently, this phenomenon is worse when he's out in the open at night like he is right now. He refuses, though, and Ganima knows then that something serious is going on. So, I feel like this little, like, experience that they're describing of that Leto has would have been really helpful to just throw in as a tidbit in the previous book with regards to Aaliyah.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, oh, at night she finds it difficult to cope with her ancestral memories crowding her head. Just, like, a throwaway line would have made the, like, later developments of her having issues so much stronger.
Yep.
Because, like, it's weird that, like, she seemed totally fine at 15, whereas Leto is 9 and already struggling with this. And I get the impression that it happens to Ganima, too, but it doesn't bother her as much. Like, the way it's written makes it seem like she experiences it, but he struggles with it more than her. Although I could be misreading that.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is that, like, the twins deal with it at 9, but there's no mention of Aaliyah having to deal with it at 15, so that it makes the fact that she's having issues now seem kind of weird. I think it would have just been nice if he'd laid the groundwork with, like, a throwaway line like this in the last book.
Yeah, and maybe he's kind of realizing that he should have done that at this point, so he's trying to, like, do that a bit more.
And he's hoping that you just, like, infer that this also happened to Aaliyah.
Yeah.
At a similar age.
Yeah, I think that's the hope there, because, I mean, he did previously, like, throw Abomination all over the place, so I think he's just hoping that you, like, connect the dots here. But yeah, I agree, it would have been nice to have some kind of context,
yeah,
you know, or even, like, a flashback from Aaliyah.
Yeah, right? Something. Yeah, I think just, like, laying some groundwork in the previous book would have been good writing.
Yep, I agree.
Ganima doesn't ask exactly what's bothering him, but she tells her brother that he knows why he's torturing himself like this, as he apparently does this with some regularity. And he admits it to himself. Despite the dangers, he wants all of those past lives. He wants to understand and experience them better. This includes all of Paul's memories of prescience, and he wants those too, although they are the most dangerous. And this is in some way related to the new thing which he is afraid to tell his sister. He stares out at a rock formation called the Attendant, where he and Ganima sometimes sneak out to a secret, hidden cave to get away from their guards and retainers and such, I think. He looks at a reservoir between there and here, filled with predator fish to prevent the sand trout from getting at the water as they would normally do, sequestering it underground before creating a spice blow. Cryptically, Leto says, "I stand between fish and worm," and when Ganima asks him to repeat himself, he just says it again, slightly louder. She begins to figure out what is going on, recognizing from her memories that Leto is acting an awful lot like their father had, being annoyingly cryptic. Saying weird things and refusing to explain them when people ask him what he's talking about. And this was related to his prescience. Ancestral memories and perhaps his father's visions are coming together in Leto's mind and revealing the history of the planet to him. He reveals that once the planet had been covered in water, but the sand trout were introduced from some other place, became an invasive species, and basically turned the whole planet into a desert, allowing the sandworm phase to take over. This explains the salt pans that we recall Paul and Jessica observing in the first book, left over from some ocean that was no longer there. Ganima believes him, but she does not wish to search her own memories for such a conclusion, presumably not wanting to go down the same kind of path that her brother is right now.
Mm-hmm.
She marvels at the idea that a sand trout, a funny little creature that Fremen children find and play with by stretching them over their hands like gloves, which makes me wonder what they look like. Like, are they sticking their hand down its throat? Like,
yeah, I mean, I sort of pictured it as being like a translucent eel looking kind of thing that you can, like, put over your hand, I guess.
But, like, how? Like,
I don't know.
I guess I was just picturing these kind of, like,
unless they're shaped like mittens. There's these little mittens that are flopping around on the ground. I don't
know.
But
again, are you, like, sticking your hand down its throat? Like, how are you putting it over your hand like a glove? I'd been kind of picturing them as, like, almost like land flounders. I don't really know why I was picturing them as like flat. But I was picturing them as these kind of like weird flat burrowing creatures. But anyway, I don't really know how you put a whole creature on your hand, but whatever. Apparently this is a fun game for Fremen children before they harvest the sand trout for water.
All right, kids, let's put our hands down the creature's throats and put them on our hands and play a game.
Dance around. Like, I don't know what you do after that point.
It's a weird idea of fun, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I guess when you grow up in the desert, there's not that much, like, fun activities to do.
What games did Frank Herbert play as a kid?
Right? At any rate, Ganeema is marveling at the idea that these tiny little weird creatures could have such an effect on an entire planet. Leto's thoughts indicate that over time, the sand trout have learned to instinctively avoid pools of water on the surface of the planet due to the use of the predatory fish, so they are no longer coming close to the water. Mm-hmm. So they're no longer coming close to where people live. So that's what's happened in the past, and presumably Paul had figured this out at some point in the past. Although maybe not, I don't know. It doesn't seem like it's common knowledge that this used to be like a water world, or at least a more, maybe just like a more Earth-like world where it had oceans.
Mm-hmm.
And then it became a desert? I don't know if that's something people know. It seems like this is revelatory knowledge.
Right.
Or maybe people knew that, but they don't know that the sandworms caused it. So Leto then raises the concern about what the effects of continuing to alter the planet in the way that they've been doing it will be. If there are no deserts left eventually and the sand trout die off, there will be no worms and no spice blows. Because obviously the worms are, well, not obviously, but I think the implication is that the worms are the, like, reproductive part of the life cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And that you need sandworms to make more sand trout, which sequester the water and create the spice blows. And also make more sandworms, which you need for the water of life.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, if they continue on the path that they're doing and completely eliminate the desert, the sandworms will all die off and there'll be no spice.
Right, which wouldn't be great for people who rely on melange.
Yeah, which is like the galaxy, or at least a significant... Well, all of the Fremen who are like addicted to it, because mm-hmm. they live on a planet where everything is like infused with spice, and then also space travel and all these other things. Leto and Ganeema think about needing to warn the tribes about this, because it doesn't seem like anyone else has figured this out. But Leto suspects that Aaliyah already knows that this is happening and will deny it to the Fremen Naibs if the twins try to bring it up. Especially because to all outside eyes, they are just 9-year-old kids. They discuss whether they could convince the Naibs by presenting it as a threat to water, or better, a threat to power. After all, the monopoly on spice is really what is keeping the Atreides Empire in control, and also therefore the Fremen. Although, I don't understand why Aaliyah would be supporting this. I guess that's the piece that I don't really get. And I mean, this is the last chapter we had to read for today, so we don't get Aaliyah's perspective, but I don't see what the benefit is to use up all the spice and never have any more. I don't know why she would be happily actively shrinking the spice supply unless she's going to stop it at some point and just maintain like a really small area of desert to like severely limit the spice supply so that she has mm-hmm. even greater power over things.
Could be.
But like, I don't know. She already has like a monopoly on it. I don't know why she would need to restrict it further.
Also, has there been less spice production now?
Yeah, like has anyone noticed?
Yeah, I mean, as they've been reverse desertification, right? As that's been the policy, like, a significant portion of the planet is green now.
So yes, yeah, so that means that like there have got to be fewer sandworms, fewer sand mm-hmm. trout. I mean, maybe it's just a slow process. Maybe it takes a long time for them to die off.
Right.
But I don't know. It's just the fact that the twins seem to think that Aaliyah already knows and would lie about it is interesting. And I would just wonder what her motives for that would be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good point.
Unless she's just like genuinely like losing her mind and wants to blow everything up. Before she has to hand over power or something. I don't know. She certainly doesn't seem like she's in the best state of mind. All right, well, I guess we'll see once we get another perspective from her in the future. But I am a bit confused about how this would benefit Aaliyah. Okay, so finally, Leto reveals his secret that he's been brooding over to his sister. He's been starting to have prescient dreams as their father had had, although apparently it's happening to Leto earlier than it did to Paul. Mm-hmm. So I guess I think in the last episode we had thought that they were probably already having prescient dreams, but it seems like they weren't.
Right.
And that it's just starting for Leto, and Ghanima hasn't had any yet, and it's not clear whether or not she will. Mm-hmm. I guess I assume that it probably will. Like, if it's happening to Leto, I assume it will eventually happen to her, but for whatever reason, it started with Leto earlier, and earlier than it did for Paul.
Right.
Leto reveals that he had actually already seen the moment from earlier today when Stilgar came to them to tell them that Jessica had been delayed. He also reveals dreams he has had of himself in armor on a place called Jakarutu, which is, based on Ghanima's reaction, generally thought to be a myth, but he insists that it's a real place. He tells her that he must find the man called the Preacher, who might be their father. Amusingly, Ghanima agrees that banishing into the desert to become a preacher would be just like him, in reference to their dad, although she isn't wholly convinced that it is actually their father. Darkly, Leto tells her that he is beginning to understand their father for the first time, as he does not like the things that he has seen himself do, presumably in these prescient dreams. For once not sharing his feelings, because she hasn't had the same experience, Ghanima feels a bit excluded and mutters that the preacher is probably just some old mystic, and Leto tells her that he desperately hopes that she is right. Mm-hmm. So he is hoping that the preacher is not, in fact, their not-dead father. Ghanima asks why he must go to Jakarutu, and he isn't sure. Apparently, Stilgar had told them that everyone who lived there was killed, and the place was therefore made taboo, but Leto somehow knows that both Danger and the Preacher are there now, and so he must go look for them, I guess, at some point. Ghanima doesn't press for details as she ordinarily would, and she knows that this reveals her great terror to her twin. They both know that down this road lies Abomination, and Leto has taken his first steps down that path by having the prescient dreams and, like, I guess, pursuing the full understanding of the prescient memories of their father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, starting to digest a lot of that information and put it together.
Mm-hmm. And maybe because he's been kind of actively doing that and seeking it out, maybe that triggered the prescient dreams in him earlier than in her. I have no, like, backing for that, but...
Mm-hmm. It could be, unless it's just genetics.
Maybe. I don't know why it would, if it's happening to him earlier than even to Paul.
Mm-hmm.
Although, I mean, I guess
he's
also
pre-born,
Paul...
So.
Well, he's preborn, and also they've both been... I mean, this doesn't explain the difference between the twins, but perhaps it will happen to both of them earlier than it did for Paul, because they've been eating spice, basically, since they were born.
Yeah, that's true.
So that could also be a factor. So, on this dark note, the twins finally return to the Siege.
Mm-hmm.
And there we end the chapter.
So, finally get a little bit more of the twins.
Mm-hmm.
So, what are your thoughts?
I mean, I'm really enjoying the chapter's focus on the twins. I think that they're really interesting characters. I think they're kind of at a cool intermediate stage. So we saw Aaliyah when she was, like, a very young preborn, like she was 2 or 3.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw Aaliyah when she was, like, 15. But they're in this kind of, like, intermediate phase where they're, you know, very adult. They're beyond the, like, oh my god, why is a toddler talking in full sentences stage? But they're also, people don't take them seriously. But they're also... in many ways very adult, but in many ways very much children. And it's interesting to see how similar they are, and yet they still have, despite having like the same set of preborn memories and kind of being imprinted with the same things, they are so alike but also different. Like, obviously, they make different choices and react differently to things sometimes. Mm-hmm. But I think they're a cool... pairing, and I've been enjoying the chapters with them, I think, the most so far.
Yeah, I think they're definitely interesting characters, and obviously we, in the previous chapter, got Gurney and Jessica back, so it's nice to have them back in the fold.
Yeah, no, I'm excited to have Jessica back in the mix. I think, I mean, I've said this before, I missed having her in the previous book. I don't know that it, like, suffered from her absence, but I missed having her perspective on things.
Yeah, definitely good to have her back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing the first meeting between Jessica and the twins.
Mm-hmm. And certainly the dynamic between Jessica and the twins and Aaliyah and the twins and Jessica and Aaliyah is going to be interesting. And then you have the Carinos off to the side who are up to no good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, got to see how this tiger plan of theirs pans out. I'm going to assume that it will not. Let me just say, I don't think that the children of Muad'Dib are going to fall to some tigers. But how many innocent decoy children will suffer in the meantime?
Who Who could tell? Yeah, who could say?
All right. Anything else, or do you want to wrap up for today?
I think we could probably wrap up at this point.
Sounds good.
Cool.
Great. I look forward to continuing reading.
Sounds good. Till next time, I'm Alex.
I'm Elaine.
Thanks for listening. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Pod Emperor of Dune. If you enjoyed listening to us, we'd appreciate a review on your podcasting host of choice, and be sure to let your friends know about us. You can find us on Twitter under the handle NerdIsayMore, or send us an email at nerdisaymore@gmail.com. If you'd like to support us further, please go to patreon.com/nerdisaymore, where you can also get access to exclusive content.